Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's another special. Today's guest is Judy Murray, and I was really excited about having her on the podcast, and it didn't disappoint. She's written a book called Knowing the Score, My Family and Our Tennis Story, and I read it all and thoroughly enjoyed the book. There is a lot which goes in. There's a lot which has gone into the making of Andy and Jamie, her sons, and this book is incredible, the amount of work she put into it. But we discuss a lot about having children who are good at sports and how much you should push them, etc. We talked about
mental health in sport.
Yeah,
Strictly.
We talked a lot about Strictly and being a celebrity.
Briefly, Dunblane.
Mm-hmm. Women in tennis.
Yeah.
And we talk about Jamie and Andy's reactions to some of her life decisions.
Oh, yeah. Don't spoil that one at the end.
Which are my favourite bits.
You can imagine the eye. She says a lot of eye rolling happens. You can imagine.
Oh, Mum. So it's all good. Thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. If you want to watch it as well, we filmed it, so it's on YouTube. You can watch it. Just go to YouTube and search Dear Lovejoy, and it's there. So let's meet her. This is Judy Murray.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
Judy, thank you for coming on the podcast. Welcome to my kitchen with all of my guests. I buy them a present. Do you drink?
Of course.
Okay. This is red wine. Do you drink red wine?
I will drink anything. Okay. Thank you.
It's nice red wine.
Wrapped in a red wrapper.
Yeah, I get it from the shop down the road, and he always gives me nice wine. So I think that'll be a good one for you.
Thank you.
Before we get stuck into your life, your book, Strictly, being an Andy and Jamie's mum, what is your job, apart from promoting the book and doing that stuff, what is your job now? Because you've had so many different jobs in tennis and things. What are you actually doing now?
Yeah, what I'm doing now is I run a couple of programs. One is called She Rallies, which I created for the LTA. That's the Lawn Tennis Association, the governing body of tennis in the UK. And it's aimed at growing a bigger and stronger female coaching workforce across the UK in order to get more girls and women playing and staying in tennis. Started it a year past February, kicked it off with an all-female coach conference, first of its kind in the UK, just women speakers and just female coach audience, tennis coaches. Followed that up with training 26 part-time ambassadors who then go out into their patches across the UK to deliver all-girl and all-women activities, so whether that's coaching, organising fun events, drop-in sessions, recreational competitions. And actually, we started with 26. We added another 30 at the end of last year, so we now got 56 part-time women promoting tennis across the UK. And the third part of it was to show the male coaches, which represents over 80% of our coaching workforce, how to work more effectively with girls and women. So that's a big part of what I do now. I do some work with the WTA on a global scale as a community ambassador. And again, that's trying to promote female coaching and getting more girls mm-hmm. Playing. Set up my own foundation, which basically takes tennis into deprived and rural areas of Scotland, builds workforces in local communities to get more people playing. Very aware that tennis is perceived as difficult to do, difficult to access, expensive. Want to smash that by, you know, taking it into places and basically investing in people in local communities. And my third thing that I'm doing is I'm at the design and business plan stage of a multi-sport centre just outside our hometown in Dunblane, which will have tennis very much at the heart of it, golf, football, gym, all sorts of leisure activities, in order to get more people off the couch, more families active, very community-focused multi-sport venue.
Are we struggling then in tennis terms with women then? Is are women not taking up the sport in this country?
Yeah, we've lost 30% of the women and girls playing tennis since 2005. That's what the research showed. And some of that is not down to tennis. It's 70% of women work now, which means they have much less time for leisure pursuits. And, you know, with something like tennis, if it's difficult to find a court and somebody to play, and it takes a long time, golf's in the same position as us. Women are finding other things to do that pockets into hour to hour and a quarter activity, you know, and running exercise classes and going to the gym have taken many women away from traditional sports. So that's one part of it. But I think that, you know, tennis is difficult to do compared to other things. And we have four times as many boys coming into tennis as girls. So, you know, we had to make, well, I created a program to make tennis more fun and more stimulating and more easy to deliver and easy to do at entry level. It's a program called Miss Hits.
Yeah.
For girls age 5 to 8, simply because we're not attracting them. And in order to attract girls, you need to understand the world in which girls operate. Girls like being with their friends. They like dancing. They like music. So I created this program that very much encompasses all of those things and pockets almost like a party environment around the skill building activities, which will make tennis more doable for them should they continue with it.
Why did you get into tennis then?
I started playing when I was about 10. I mean, when I was 10, that was like 48 years ago. You kind of had to be at least 10 or 11 to do it because the rackets were wooden and heavy and the courts were big. So nowadays, kids can start with mini rackets and sponge balls and badminton-sized courts and little nets. But back then, you know, you had to be about 10 or 11 before you could actually pick up the racket. And basically started with my parents. They were both county level players and they taught me how to play, because in those days, tennis coaching wasn't a thing. Certainly not, it wasn't in Scotland, because you couldn't play all year round because the weather's terrible and there was no indoor courts. So it was very much a summer sport, played badminton in the winter. But yeah, I learned from my parents.
Your dad invented topspin, didn't he?
He did. He thinks he did. In fact, he's convinced that he did. He said, I was doing that before Bjorn Borg. That Bjorn Borg was doing it.
Yeah, because it's funny, tennis has moved on so dramatically, hasn't it? Over the years, what's interesting, I think, about tennis is, didn't people used to hit it flat, and then it was only when Borg and that lot came along they started hitting it with topspin, wasn't it? The sport was just hit flat, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very flat. And you'd be encouraged always to hit the ball between sort of knee and waist height, and that nobody knew what spin was. There was slice around on the backhand. You'd come down the back of the ball, but it was pretty much Borg that brought in the whole thing of dropping the head below the ball and brushing it up so that you got the spin, so you had a different outcome, made it more difficult for the person on the other side of the net, which of course is the goal with any sport.
And there was no such thing as a double-handed backhand. Oh no, there was, but did Borg have a double-handed backhand?
Yeah, he had a double-handed backhand, but you know...
But most men had the single-handed backhand, didn't they?
Most men, and actually most women, certainly when I was very young, most women had single-hand backhands. The double-hander was kind of only just coming in. But if you think about it, nowadays the double-hander is so common because kids start younger.
Right.
And when they start younger, they need to put another hand on to make them more secure on the opposite side of their body. So they grow up with the double-handed backhand. Whereas when I was young, if you start at 10, 11, 12 or older, you can manage with one hand, and therefore that was just how people played.
But now if you were if whoever plays, you would say the double-handed backhand is probably has advantages over the single-handed backhand, unless you're Federer.
It certainly does in terms of power and security. And if you think how hard people serve the ball at now, and how physical the game's become, you know, in terms of generating power and counter-attacking, having two hands gives a greater degree of security. But I think you have much longer, well, maybe not much longer, you have a longer reach with a single-handed backhand. And the single-handed backhand lends itself better to being able to slice the ball and to make a backhand volley. You have two hands on the slice and two hands on the backhand volley. You don't quite get the same effect.
I went to watch these qualifying tournament once, down at the LTA or somewhere like that. And this guy had two forehands. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
It's just amazing. He was hitting the ball forehand with his right, and then moved, and he had slightly shorter grip because he had to grip further up, and he would just change it straight to the left and hit it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you do get occasional players like that, you know, very ambidextrous, and they choose to play like that. The stronger wing is usually the wing that they decide to serve with, the arm that they decide to serve with. But yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of quite famous players who have played like that. But you also get double-handed on both sides. Monica Seles is a great example of double-handed on both sides, because when you start that young, you put the other hand on for security, and sometimes you never take it off.
How good were you at tennis? You were Scotland's number one, weren't you, at some age levels?
I was. I think that might sound quite good, but you have to put it into context of it being very much a minority sport in Scotland, and very few people playing the game to any great level. So, I mean, you can only beat what's put in front of you, but the numbers of competitors among girls and women when I was playing were very, very small. I was number 8 junior in Britain in my last year of juniors. That was probably quite good for coming from Scotland, from, you know, and not having the coaching or the infrastructure that perhaps there were in other parts of the UK. And I played for Great Britain in the World Student Games. That was a big thrill for me, you know, as a student at Edinburgh University, and got picked to go to Romania to play in that, which is a huge multi-sport event. I think it's only second in terms of size to the Olympics. Massive event.
Women's tennis, though, is big around the world. Is it that just our perception because it's so big at Wimbledon?
No, it's a huge global sport, you know, and I'm often asked that, you know, about the difference between men's side of the game and the women's side of the game. And I said, well, you know, in tennis, we're so lucky compared to other sports because the women have the opportunity to... Women's tennis is on TV many, many weeks of the year. We are very visible in tennis around the world. And the four Grand Slams, of course, are men and women. And there are a number of the bigger events on the tour at large venues where you have joint events. And the crowds that they get into that are absolutely massive. So there, you know, and we've also been lucky in tennis to have had Serena Williams, Venus Williams, and Maria Sharapova, three of the most marketable women in sport, who happen to be tennis players, you know, and so therefore potential to earn money and put yourself in front of people, endorsements, prize money and so forth, is huge in tennis, and you can't say that for very many female sports.
The Billie Jean King, though, which, hold on, Mark, is my mic all right here? Because it doesn't seem very loud in my ear. Is that okay?
It's fine.
Yeah, okay, cool. Can you just turn my headphones up slightly then? Because it just seems really quiet.
That's just
very strange. How much did Billie Jean King have to do with it? Because I watched that movie. I can't remember what the name of the movie was.
Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that true, that whole thing? Was she influential in getting the women the equal
it's
pay?
It's such a great film. I've seen it 3 times and it's absolutely brilliant.
It's a good film, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely worth going to see. And I think what it does is it reminds you of how different the tennis world was way back then, and how much she and the other 9 women who all bandied together... how much they went out on a limb to create what has now become the women's tour, you know, and they just got to a stage where they were so sort of incensed and fed up with the difference between what the men were getting paid. The men were always on the big courts. They were almost like a sideshow, and they created their own tour, and they really fought hard to make the women's tour what it has now become. And, you know, Billie Jean King, she's like, absolute shiro in fact of mine, because she's 73 now, and she's still fighting. She fights for equality, not just gender equality. She fights for racial equality, everything. She's such a great leader. She's got such a huge heart, and I see what she has done and continues to do, and I wish more of the top female players would put their backs into it now and almost like take over the mantle from her.
I've read a few articles with you, and you mentioned some of your stuff in the book as well about how hard it is for the young girls to go out on tour, though. They're a vulnerable time in their lives, and a lot of the coaches are men as well, which is what you were alluding to earlier on in this. Is it tougher for the girls to go out on the tour?
I think it is. It's... I mean, you need to be on the road probably 35 to 40 weeks of the year. It's not easy. I mean, I've always said that, and I've seen it, you know, the need for emotional support. You're away from home, you're away from friends and family, you're growing up, you know, the world is changing for you. There's a lot of pressure on you to make a living, because in a sport like tennis, you as a player are responsible for all your own costs. So that's not just your travel accommodation, yeah, your restrings, physio, etc. You're responsible for paying your coach's fees and your coach's expenses. So it's really only the players at the very top of the game that can afford to travel with an entourage. So as you're an up-and-coming player, you're lucky if you can afford a coach to travel with you. If you go on your own, you're vulnerable. You know, where do you get your emotional support from there? Who do you talk to? And it's why so many parents assume the role of coach with their kids. They learn how to coach because they can't afford to pay somebody else to do it, and they need to know that their child is being looked after. So it is lonely. You can be very vulnerable, and it's a tough gig.
I had Matthew Syed on this podcast, and we discussed about what's the word we used. I'm going to use the word pushy parents. Do you need, that's the wrong word, but do you need a committed, let's use that word, do you need a committed parent if you're going to make it an individual sport like tennis or golf or one of those sort of sports? Do you need that support?
Oh, 100%. You know, in any individual sport or activity, probably, I imagine it's the same in the arts. You know, the onus is on the parents to make things happen for their kids. You know, I always say if my kids had been exceptional at cricket or football or rugby, they'd have been signed up by a club, they'd have been paid a wage, the training, the fixtures, the kit, the transport, everything would have been provided, and I largely wouldn't have had to do very much. But you know, in something like tennis, you know from a young age you're trying to find a coach, you're trying to book courts, you're paying for lessons, you're entering them in the competitions, you're driving around the country and sometimes abroad, and you're having to manage everything. So you become like the human ATM machine, the taxi driver, the laundrette, the coach, the manager, the, you know, everything. So you absolutely need the parents to be in it with you.
Why did you do it?
Yeah, I think, you don't know what you're getting into when you start out. You know, I think when my kids were very small, I just wanted them to enjoy sport as much as I'd enjoyed sport when I was young. And so they had sporty parents and sporty grandparents. So they basically had a number of people who would play anything with them anytime they wanted. So they developed, as a result, really good hand-eye and foot-eye coordination skills at a young age. And like Jamie had a 3 handicap of golf when he was 15. Like for my kids, it was never about the tennis. Andy was just as good at football as he was at tennis, and he had to make a choice between the two.
I've played with Andy at football.
Have you?
Yeah, he's very good. He is a good player.
Yeah, he could have gone down the footballing route.
Yeah.
But
I've also played with Tim Henman as well. He's very good as well.
He's not bad.
Yeah, because you just assume
underestimated.
You assume that if you're just if you're good at one sport like Andy is and Tim is at tennis, you assume they're probably not that. They're very good. And the thing about Andy and Tim, if you ever play football against a tennis player, is their 0-60. Their acceleration is unbelievable. I remember running for a ball once with, I think it was, I played 5-a-side with Andy. I played 11-a-side against Tim Henman. I remember going for a ball. He just went past me so quickly because they're so rapid.
Yeah. Speed off the mark.
The mark is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the team I played, we played against a team of tennis players. It was like playing on something off, you know, The Matrix or something. They were like... Absolutely incredible. But yeah, go on. So they were, Andy was good at football as well.
So when they were young, we wanted them to try everything, and they pretty much did try everything except skiing, I think, because basically no mountains in Dunblane, plenty of rotten weather. But yeah, so you know, it was never just about the tennis. And I think that's another thing that people often get wrong, you know, that they were brought up to be tennis players. And when they were very little, I was a sales rep. I had to give up my job when Andy was born, but I wasn't a tennis coach. I kind of went over to our local tennis club to volunteer to give me a chance to get out of the house when my kids were small, and just did a couple of hours a week when my mum could look after the boys. And it just kind of snowballed from there. But my point really is you don't know what you're getting into. I never would have imagined I'd become a full-time tennis coach when I went over to volunteer for a couple of hours a week. And I never would have imagined my kids would be Wimbledon champions when they started playing at the local tennis club when they were 5 and 6.
What age did you think they've got potential?
I think there's a difference between knowing that they've got potential and I don't think you ever know whether they can maximize that potential. What you do know as a parent is that it's up to you to create the opportunities.
How hard is that, though, juggling creating opportunities and being putting too much emphasis on success for them, being pushy? I don't know what the right terminology is here, but it must be quite tough as a parent that you give them enough opportunities, but then sometimes you think they're just not having a life here, because you, to be as good as Andy and Jamie have got, you've had to spend a lot of time on a tennis court. And we've seen it so often. Tiger Woods' dad, the Williams sisters' dad, it seems that everybody have really committed parents. But then you can see at local tennis courts and golf clubs and football grounds and stuff, parents who are a bit too much committed to that idea of them being...
Yeah, I think in an individual sport, because the parent has to do so much, there is always the possibility that parents will become over emotionally involved in it and over financially committed, because, you know, you end up spending a fortune making it happen. And you can understand why some parents start to feel the pressure of the cost of it all, the time commitment of it all. But I think that, you know, Tiger Woods' dad and Serena and Venus's dad, they set out to make their children champions. That was their goal.
Yeah.
I never did that. I just wanted my kids to enjoy sport, and I'm as surprised as anybody, you know, where we all ended up. But as far as I'm concerned, you create the opportunities, you support. But you know, because we were doing it in Scotland, where there was no track record of success in tennis, there was no world-class coaches, there was no infrastructure, I ended up in a position where I became the Scottish national coach, I think a little bit by default. I don't think anybody wanted the job. The job had been vacant for about 18 months, and I just had passed the LTA's highest coaching qualification, which was called the Performance Coach Award. It was a brand new course, and I was the first woman to pass it. That doesn't make you a good coach. That gives you a qualification and loads of information. But what you want, I mean, and I've learned it in my time, is the quickest way to get good at something is to work alongside somebody who's great at what they do. Well, I had nobody to work alongside because nobody was doing it in Scotland. Tennis coaching just simply wasn't a thing. Producing tennis players wasn't a thing. So, you know, when I started as a national coach, I started with a salary of £25,000. I had a budget of £90,000. And we had one indoor centre that had just opened at a university, which happened to be 5 miles from where we lived, which was a bonus. But I had to book courts there out of my £90,000 budget. I had no staff, I had no office. You know, I had the job and a car. So I started with 20 children, aged between 7 and 11. And Andy would have been one of the youngest at 7, and Elena Baltasha would have been one of the oldest at 11. But out of our little cottage industry, which we could only get courts really on the weekend to bring everybody together initially, and because I had no staff, I brought in all the parents. So the parents had to help, whether they were manning matches, making sandwiches, putting other kids up, doing car rotas. We kind of found a way to make it work in those early days. But, you know, out of those 20 kids, we got 4 Davis Cup players and 1 Fed Cup player.
So how good a coach are you? Pretty good.
I don't know. But I think a lot of it is understanding children. And I learned a lot from my own kids about the importance of creating a fun environment and a mixed environment, boys and girls, different ages, lots of them. So you don't get fed up playing with the same person all the time. And it's always about creating the games and activities that do the teaching for you.
Okay, how do you juggle it then? Because the kids have to be committed if they're going to go on to be successful. The parents have to be committed to it as well. Yet, most of them will fail. That's the reality. Yeah. Same. If you're a parent out there and you have children, we just saw recently, and it's horrible news, the snowboarding girl, Hedy Suter, who obviously felt amazing pressure at 18, and not saying it's her parents' fault or anyone around her fault, but she felt amazing pressure apparently to succeed, and she couldn't deal with it in the end. How do you stop that happening? How do you get people to commit to the sport, but then get them to realize that there is a chance of failure and all the pressures which go with it?
Well, I think you have to be very realistic, and you're right. In a sport like tennis, you need to be quite well inside the top 100 to be making a profit on what you're doing, because the expenses, the costs attached to traveling the world and playing tournaments 30, 35 weeks a year are massive, absolutely massive. So the reality is that very few people will make a living out of playing tennis. So you have to understand what the other options are. You want to keep kids in the game. You want to keep them improving. So things like scholarships at American universities, scholarships at some of the UK universities, tennis scholarships. You need to be realistic, and you also need to know that because the likelihood is that most of them will not make a career out of it, there are other avenues in tennis where you could make a career, you know, whether that's broadcasting, journalism, coaching, running competitions, refereeing. There's all sorts of things with you know, other avenues in tennis, but you need to get the balance when the kids are young. You need to ensure there's a balance between the social, the educational, and the sport. And I see too many situations where parents are influenced by somebody saying, we think your child's really great, they've got potential and whatever, whatever. And they're suddenly remortgaging the house, they're moving the family away from home to invest in an 11 or 12-year-old who has some potential. And actually they're changing the whole family way of life to try and give an 11 or 12-year-old an opportunity. And I say, you're crazy. You can develop the skills and you can... Because... My kids learn for the most part. I mean, Andy left home when he was 15 to go to Barcelona. Jamie finished school and went to train in Paris because they played tennis completely differently. They need completely different environments. They had to leave the country, of course, to do it. But they left at a time when they were old enough to know that that was what they wanted to do. It wasn't, you know, when Jamie was 12, he went down to one of the LTA's academies in Cambridge, and it was an absolute disaster, and it was a massive mistake from me. But I was influenced by a coach who had coached Pat Cash to Wimbledon title, Australian guy, wonderful coach, who offered Jamie a place at an academy. And it was just, he was too young. I was inexperienced, and now I completely advise against that, because I see, you know, you take away the friends, the family, the school environment, the coaches that have nurtured the talent. You take away all the security, and they're too young to deal with it. They need to be old enough to know their own mind.
So this is the thing I was discussing with Matthew Sydon here, is you talk about balance there, and yet we are fed constantly that the Williams sisters, they didn't have a balance. They just got they just hit balls 24 hours a day, you know, out of shopping trolleys, and Tiger Woods, he didn't have a balance, and all those guys, we're told that Nadal, all he did was hit all day long and non-stop, blah 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 blah. So can you find a balance, or do the ones, I mean, you know, because you had a number one tennis playing son, two of them, so do you know, can you find a balance, or is the balance really a commitment to the sport?
I think for me, one of the challenges we have in this country is that we don't have enough world-class nurturers of talent, certainly not in tennis. If we did, we'd have more players, because it's become about volume. And actually, of course, you need to put in enough hours, but I'd go for quality over quantity when kids are young. And let them play other sports as well. And then when they're older, you can put the volume in to really hone those skills. That's the way that I would advise it. I think putting in loads and loads of hours to the exclusion of other activities, friends, et cetera, at a very young age is far more likely to lead to burnout and getting fed up with your environment and what you're doing.
So Andy became number one tennis player in the world, singles. Jamie was number one doubles player in the world at a certain stage. But are they the product of the French and Spanish tennis system rather than the British system then? Is that what we're saying?
Well, I think they had a lot of opportunities through the British system of travelling to competitions in other countries when they were very young. But, you know, at the end of the day, they both had to leave the country to find the right training environment to help to maximize their potential. So Barcelona is the hotbed of European tennis. So many players, a real culture of tennis in Spain, more top 10 players than any other country, I think, in certainly in the men's side, possibly in the women's side as well. So you go over there and they're used to winning. There's just people playing tennis everywhere, not just kids, not just adults. It is a big thing over there. Tennis isn't a big thing in the UK, you know, and we're competing with so many other things for kids and adults' attention now. that it's almost like the numbers are getting less. And the other thing that's happened is that coaching has become such a thing that more kids and adults than ever before have tennis coaching, and less kids and adults than ever before actually play the game.
Oh, is that good or bad?
I think it's bad. It's terrible because the fun of sport is playing the game.
Okay.
So if I go back to when I started, there wasn't coaching. You learned to play, well, with your parents and then with the other kids at the club, and then with the other adults at the club taught you how to play the game. But now that there's so much coaching, kids are programmed into activities after school every day. So maybe that's a lot to do with both parents working. I don't know. But you've got to learn to play the game. The coaching has got to lead to the game. And in a lot of instances, certainly in tennis, it isn't leading to them playing the game.
Yeah. Sorry to keep going back to this, but it seems that, do we prepare the children for not making it? I see it a lot in football. The kids, because I've got mates who've got kids in football clubs now, and they just get dropped. Boof, and it's like,
yeah, it's brutal, isn't it?
All their dreams. It must happen in tennis where, you know, eventually you're just not making it, the money runs out, boof, and then it's so hard for, because years ago I think you made it when you were a bit older, but now they're being trained from such an early age to be this thing, and it's defining them.
Yeah.
It's quite a mental thing, isn't it, for children and youths to have to deal with when it suddenly the dream comes to an end.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I had an experience of that recently with a player who I started off when they were seven and got to a stage at 18 where was questioning whether it was what they really wanted to do, questioning whether they were going to be good enough and so forth. And what came out of conversations around that, it wasn't somebody that I've worked with since they were about 13, but the conversations that came out of that were, it was exactly as you said, you become defined by not just by yourself, by your peer group, by the people you were at school with, by your family, as you are X, the tennis player. And then suddenly you realize this is not working out the way that I wanted it to, or I'm not enjoying it, or it's not, you know, it's not what I want to do anymore. And it's very hard to let it go without feeling like you failed, because everybody just sees you as, you were going to be a tennis player, and you have to go in and tell people, I'm not doing it anymore. It's really tough. And that's where I've always said that it's so important to have real grounded common sense people around you to help you deal with the ups and the downs and the highs and the lows, and that you are valued, you know, whatever happens. And you know, mental health among young people now is such a huge thing.
Yes. Definitely.
Such a huge thing. We have to be careful.
I always think in sport, it's really one of the bit of things that I don't think gets maybe discussed enough. Maybe it does in tennis, but the idea that you're going to get injured, if you've got a tennis career, you are 100% certain you're going to have an injury for some of that tennis career. Mm. It's a fact. There's not been a tennis player ever who's not had an injury, as far as I'm aware. And you're 100% going to lose matches. Federer loses matches, Borg loses matches, Andy's lost matches, everybody loses, and yet it seems to just hit them so hard always. Is that about being a winner, or are they not preparing themselves?
Well, I think being injured is part and parcel of sport. I mean, if you are someone like Federer, hardly had an injury in his incredibly long and successful career, had a surgery maybe a year and a half or so ago and has recovered from it incredibly, incredibly well. Yeah. If you look at how he moves in a very biomechanically efficient, natural way. He doesn't do much of his training in the gym. He doesn't rely on muscle, which builds stiffness and weight. He does everything on the court. So he trains his body to do what his sport is going to ask him to do.
Hold on, but we've moved away from that. That's what McEnroe used to do. And then Martina Navratilova came along and everybody said, we've got to do the stuff in the gym. And then they've all become...
And eat pasta.
Yeah.
She was the one who brought pasta to everything.
And they've all become now, you know, absolutely ripped and they've amazing bodies. Are we saying now we need to go back to the old days, the McEnroe days?
That's my kind of feeling. I think you've got to look at what the sport demands of you, and each sport will have different demands. Like you were talking about speed off the mark and change of direction. That's what tennis demands of you. It's not running 100 meter sprints or 20 meter sprints even. You know, in tennis you need 2, 3, 4 steps max, then change of direction. So you need, that's what your training needs to revolve
around. Andy spent ages building himself up, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. So you can build up the muscle, and it can make you heavier, and it can make you stiffer, and that can change your your playing style. This is what I mean about having people around you who understand your body, who understand what tennis will demand, who understand your style of play and your personality. Yeah, you know, you need to have expert people who completely understand what's going on. And I see in tennis, far too many of our young players going to fitness trainers who don't play tennis, don't understand tennis, and train them in exactly the same way as rugby players or netballers or whatever. And it's all about, you know, in the gym, and it's building weights and all
strength
the rest
and conditioning, strength and conditioning.
Absolutely.
One size fits all.
Yeah,
no, it doesn't at all. You're right. I was saying to you before we started the podcast, it's interesting because you, I've got to be honest, all I can do is look at the headlines. I've met you a few times and I've always thought you're a charming person and everything, but all I could ever do was look at the headlines of what they would say about you. And then I read your book, and your commitment to Andy and Jamie has been absolutely off the scale. I mean, the things you've done for them, including financially and everything else emotionally, it never quite came across in the press that way, did it?
I never used to do any interviews. I think for many years I didn't. And I think, you know, in 2005, when that was the year that Andy got wildcard into Wimbledon, and he made the third round, that was the time when he really catapulted into the spotlight. And as a result, we around him did as well, to a lesser extent. But, you know, I often look back on that Wimbledon and think, you know, nobody prepared us for anything like that happening. You know, what do you do when you suddenly being followed by paparazzi and you people are doorstepping you, and the BBC are showing you clapping in slow motion? And
yeah, but before we get to there, we just got to point out that you have been in financial right on the lines, haven't you? Constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly begging people for money to help Andy and Jamie to get their careers going, just invest in them for coaching because you knew they had some talent, and there is money there. Let's face it, tennis isn't poor. And you saw that Andy had an injury early, and you thought, right, well, we need to get this injury fixed. So you've absolutely just, you know, dedicated your life to trying to help these two boys get their success in tennis. So then when you arrive, but there was a woman once, wasn't there, actually, in your book you mentioned, who gave you £10,000. Tell us that story quickly.
Oh, yeah, that was a great story. It was just after Andy had won US Open 2004, the junior event, and that was a good sign because he was 17, just turned 17, which means he could have played in the juniors the following year. So we'd come back from the US Open Juniors, and I was still working as a Scottish national coach. I went to Sports Scotland. I was kind of begging them, as usual, to try and give me more money for my program for all of the young players that were doing really well and were having to train outside the country. It's expensive. To develop a young tennis player is incredibly expensive. Tennis is an expensive sport, no matter what anybody tells you. Nobody really understands just quite how expensive that is. And when your kids start playing abroad for, you know, world junior ranking points, it's like going on holiday every week, but without the fun. But the costs are the same. It really is, because there's no prize money in junior tennis, so you're just paying out all the time. So there's huge financial commitment. There's a huge time commitment, because somebody has to go with them. Somebody has to look after them. Somebody has to manage everything. They can't do it by themselves. So it's just, there is a massive, massive onus on the parents to make things happen. So for me, I came back from that US Open 2004. Sports Scotland wouldn't give me any more money. In fact somebody said to me, you know, when I made this presentation and said, now we, you know, 10 years after I started as national coach with nothing, we have now got a junior Grand Slam champion. And this guy who I was speaking to said, but we're not interested in junior Grand Slam champions. We're interested in Grand Slam champions. And I just looked at him and I just thought, you know what? That's it. I'm done. And so I handed in my resignation a couple of days later. And in those 3 months, I was really trying so hard to get some sponsorship, because suddenly I'm giving up my salary and I'm giving up my car, you know, to try and concentrate on what Andy and Jamie were doing. But I had to believe that winning US Open Juniors would open some doors with sponsorship. But generally speaking, if you come from a country like Scotland with no track record of success in tennis, it's very difficult to get people to believe that you've got a potential champion on your hands. So it was nearly always getting doors closed and don't be silly, run along, you know, tennis champions in Scotland, don't be daft. And so a few months after that, out of the blue came this letter to my house from a lady who said she was Scottish, she loved tennis, she lived in London, and she was so blown away by Andy winning, a Scot winning the US Open Juniors, and she wanted to help. And I had no idea in what way she wanted to help, and I wrote back to her and thanked her very much and whatever. And a few days after that, she sent me a cheque for £10,000 from her and her friend, and they said, we just want to help, we don't want anything in return, we just want to help. And it was an absolute lifeline for me. It's like the fairy godmother. It absolutely came at the right time. And she and her friend were able to come and watch Andy when he got a wild card into Queens that year, because of course he was playing outside of the country in all those ensuing months. And they came to watch him at Queens. They saw him win his first ATP Tour match at Queens. And then the saddest thing happened. She died the following day. And she said to me, look after that boy. He's going to be a star. And I never had anybody ever say that to me before. Somebody who just genuinely, absolutely believed, in him. But she and her friend threw me a lifeline. And it's amazing.
So you've worked really hard. It's a great story, that. You worked really hard. You got all the money, and Andy starts getting success. You're suddenly on the BBC. And as you say, then suddenly the headlines start going against you a bit, don't they? And no one's actually bothering to say the backstory of how supportive you've been for, it's suddenly like, oh, they're dragging their mum along, rather than, and if it was a dad, and I think you point this out in your book, if it's a dad, people wouldn't care that there's the supportive dad. But because you were suddenly there and you're supporting your son, suddenly it's like this this mum's just overpowering mum was sort of the image that you that was portrayed about you, wasn't it? How did that feel when that happened?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it doesn't, like I said, nothing prepares you for it. And suddenly you're seeing pictures of yourself in the paper where every picture was me, pumping my fist and baring my teeth, like this.
I remember
it. And I could understand why people would think, oh, she's mad, she's aggressive, she never smiles. I could understand it, because the media in all its shapes and forms, whether it was, the newspapers or whether it was the TV, it was always, they seemed to cut to me doing something like that. And it made me realize a lot of things. One, that, nearly all sports photographers, sports journalists and sports editors are men. And, I was that unusual dynamic of a mother of two sons in an individual sport. And it also made me realize about tennis and Wimbledon in particular, that, there's no ad breaks. So there's 20 seconds between points. There's 90 seconds at an end change. And the cameras and the commentators need somewhere to go. So they find you. Whereas if I'd been a footballer's mum, they would never have known I existed, because I'd be hidden in the crowd somewhere and you'd never be looking for it. So I just, it made me realize a whole lot of things. But again, nobody helps you how to deal with that.
So how did it impact you then? I mean, you suddenly start looking at yourself constantly on camera and stuff. How did you feel about that? And people are critiquing you then, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they do.
And being a woman, you get critiqued on your looks.
You do. You get much more judged as a woman.
Yeah, you do.
Are judged on what you look like and what you're wearing.
Yep.
And I used to buy every newspaper in those days. I wanted to know what people were saying about Andy mostly. And then I realized it. And then I realized that all the things that I say to Andy when something nasty is written or said about him is that, the people who matter are your friends and family who know you. It doesn't matter what somebody writing an opinion piece who's never actually seen you before. But, I mean, a lot of that was bluff. A lot of that was, I'm saying that because it's the right thing to say to him, and I'm trying to sell it to myself. But I had to put it up with that for years. But I didn't, I didn't do interviews. I didn't retaliate on anything. And then, really after Andy won his Olympics and his U.S. Open, but actually after he won Wimbledon, by which time I'd become the Fed Cup captain, I was becoming more confident. And when he won Wimbledon, I started to use my voice and I started to retaliate a bit. And doing the book actually helped me a lot, because it allowed me to tell the backstory of what happened, because I was being made to feel like, by a lot of people, that I shouldn't be sitting in the player box supporting my son. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I've been there since he played his first tournament. I've been through all the junior circuit when I'd be the only person supporting him. the only person in the stand supporting him. And but I was being made to feel bad about being there, and I thought, this is completely wrong.
I've always say I like to think I'm thick-skinned, and then one day I realized I wasn't. And it's not when people insult me, which they do all the time, that I think I want to go away in the corner of the room and cry. I just want to rip their heads off, because I get so angry about it, and then I hate myself for having that sort of feeling. But that's how I feel, especially when journalists absolutely take me apart. It's so bizarre when they just, I find it quite, sometimes I find it quite funny now. When I was once I was linked to the death of the Russian spy in the Yo Sushi, and I was like, how the hell have I been involved in that? And it was like, I wasn't actually linked personally to the death, but they, you managed to have a go at me in the story about that, and I was like, that is really bizarre. That's surreal. But yeah, it's quite a hard thing. I don't think people quite understand that there's a person behind those when people are writing those headlines. So how does it feel then when you're a mother, and Andy's had it pretty tough, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
How does that, I know Andy, well, I don't know him, I've met him a load of times. He's really lovely, funny, charming man. The papers absolutely hammered him for years, didn't they? How did that feel being a mum then, and understanding that he was the way he was, yet they were portraying him another way?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough. It's tough to read that stuff, because, like you say, you're thinking, what you're seeing is you're seeing Andy the competitor.
Yeah.
And certainly in the early days, you're seeing Andy the teenager, and he's learning to do what he wants to do. He's trying his best. He's an incredible competitor, incredible fighter. He's a perfectionist, and he's young, and he shows his frustrations. He wears his heart on his sleeve, but actually away from the court, he's incredibly chilled and relaxed and all the rest of it. But you're seeing him in a stressful situation in the same way as you might be seeing me in a stressful situation in the player box. Yeah. So you make your judgment on what you see. And because he's never chased fame or money, he just wants to be the best that he could be in his sport. He doesn't do chat shows and things where he shows his, you know, he does a little bit more now with that. But when you're young, it was never his thing. So people only ever saw how he was on the court. And then you get, you know, you found him being criticized for, you know, his haircut or his lack of haircut, his facial hair, his grumpy, his boring voice, his dour teenager, and swearing on the court, like everything. And I think, oh, God, poor kid, you know, he's doing his best out there, but, you know, he absolutely couldn't win for many, many years.
But how's that feel being a mum?
Yeah, horrendous, absolutely horrendous, because then you're having to help to manage that.
He used to wind me up, because I used to stick up for him, and we were on Soccer AM and things, talking about him and everything else, and people used to hammer me for sticking up for him. It's like, no, I've met him, he's a really lovely bloke. And the thing about Andy is where he was different from maybe a lot of, I'm not going to say that because I'll get myself into trouble, but he wanted to win. He was a competitor, and that he was focused. And sometimes I think we struggle with that. He's not the clown. He's not the loser. He wanted to win. And you know, if he was an American, they'd absolutely love that.
Yeah.
But we struggled with the idea that that was it. When I first met him, he just started talking to me about rankings and percentages. He was obsessed with tennis.
Yeah, he's a real student of the game and has been from a very, from a very young age. But yeah, I mean, I have that all the time. People saying to me, you know, why doesn't he smile more on court? It's like, what's there to smile about?
He's there,
you know,
to win a tennis
just get
match.
Distracted. You know, it's like they don't understand. You know, it's like, I wish he looked like he was enjoying himself more. It's like, he actually is.
Yeah.
He actually is. He doesn't need to smile to be enjoying, you know, what he's doing. He thrives on the competition, on the fight.
Yeah. And then what's it like being a mum when you've got two sons? It became really apparent when I was reading your book, and you do talk about it in here. You've got two sons, and they're both obviously in the same sport, and they're both great. But Andy's going on to at one stage, they were both playing singles, and Andy's going on to become eventually world number one. And Jamie's not doing so well. He's doing well, but not as well as Andy. How hard must that be as a mum, juggling that as well?
Yeah, that's tough, because, you know, you want to create the same opportunities or the right opportunities for both of them, and you want to support both of them. And when they kind of went off in different directions, they were in different directions with their training bases, they were in different directions actually with their careers. Like you said, you know, Andy took off very quickly from 2005 beginning of 2005, he was about 450 in the world. By the end of 2005, he was 64 in the world. He's like in the top 100. And Jamie's, you know, somewhere down around 700 or 800, doing better in doubles, but that's where he was, you know, in singles. And that's hard. And I remember when Andy won his first ATP Tour title in San Jose, Jamie and me were in a travel lodge in Sheffield. There's a time difference, so we had to go to sleep because Jamie had a final of a Futures event. That's the first rungs of the men's tour the following day. And woke up, switched the phone on, Andy had won. Get on the phone to Andy, well done, da, 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 da. Very conscious, Jamie's playing his big final in Sheffield. Go to the tennis courts in Sheffield, the indoor court, park in the car park because he needs to warm up and practice and all the rest of it. And there are three TV camera vans in the car park. And that's strange, you know, don't usually get TV at this level of event. And we go in and they're setting up on the court, and of course, then we discover they're actually not there for Jamie's final. They're there to get some sound bites and some backdrop action of Jamie to go against the story of Andy. And it was one of those really tough situations where really hard for Jamie. He played horribly and he lost. Right. And he was really upset because of the distraction of the cameras and the journalists and knowing that nobody was there for him, and for him it was a big thing. That was the first of me starting to realize, oh, this is going to be really, really hard. And but you know, eventually Jamie found his niche in doubles. His skills are perfectly suited to doubles and carved a career for himself out in doubles. And you know, he was the one who won Wimbledon first in 2007, won the mixed doubles. He was the one who got to number one in the world first in April 2016. Andy made it in October 2016. It was almost like he always sort of led the way in some things. And yet it's been harder for him because, you know, he goes in and does a press conference after his matches. And if he's asked 10 questions, 9 of them will be about Andy. God, you know, it's a grind. It's a complete and utter grind. And I said, don't answer them. Just say, I'm here to talk about my tennis. Just don't answer them.
But if you do that, aren't they going to then just start?
have a go at him as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one, that, isn't it? Must be a hard thing to deal with. It must made you happy, though, when he's been so successful in his career as well. And also, it must be amazing when Andy actually went on to start winning everything. Like, because we always had that thing of, oh, we're the great nation of never quite making it, Tim Henman and all that. Then when he wins Olympic and then US Open and then Wimbledon, number one in the world ranking. It must have been an amazing feeling for you and obviously for him. But
yeah, I mean, amazing, amazing for, you know, for him. I think for all of us who've been around him for, you know, for all his life, and we've seen how hard he's worked and how much he's pushed himself and how much he's had to put up with. You know, it was incredible. Watching him win the Olympics was just an amazing thing because it came just...
It was for us all. It was amazing.
And, you know, so good. It was a few weeks after he'd lost the final of Wimbledon to Federer, you know, and
is that with the one where he cried?
Yeah.
And said, I'm sorry.
Yeah, because he felt he'd let everybody down. Because, you know, and this is probably as a result of a lot of the media pressure.
Yeah, and what's it like having the whole nation's hopes on your shoulders? It must be really tough. You're not just playing for yourself and your mum and your family. You're also playing for everyone in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think any of us can ever imagine the sort of pressure that he was under. Of course, he puts pressure on himself because he wants to be the best. But, you know, the pressure from the media, from the public, you know, and ever since he won that US Open Junior thing in 2004, you can guarantee pretty much every press conference he did after that was, you know, well, when are you going to win Wimbledon then? When are you going to win? And I remember him saying to me after he won Wimbledon in 2013, saying, you know what, Mum? They'll never be asking me that again.
Yeah.
And actually, it didn't take long for them to say, well, when are you going to win Wimbledon again?
That must have been such an amazing feeling for him to do that. It's such a mental sport, tennis, I think. I mean, I took it up a few years. I'm not playing now because I had a back operation, but I took it up and played it for a while. And I just, you know, having played lots of sports, I found tennis really mentally hard because every point you can play in your head over and over, if I win this, then I'm da 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 da, da. And if I do that, and then if I do, and you start it mentally, it's tough, isn't it? And then if you're if you're 40 love down, do you, and you're Andy and you're tired, do you bother going to try and make it all the way back to win that game, or do you just give it up? How does it all work mentally? Is that a tough thing to get your head around when you're a tennis player?
It's a very cerebral sport. You know, the whole, you're playing the opponent, you're playing the score, you're playing the ball. You're problem solving every point. In fact, you're problem solving actually every shot that you hit, because the shot that you hit, you're reacting to what your opponent has hit, and you never know where your opponent's going to hit it, how high, how hard, how soft, where, what angle. It's why, you know, like when we're coaching, we need to coach kids to think for themselves, to be independent problem solvers. We have to coach, and that's why the whole thing that I was talking about earlier about too much coaching and not enough playing the game. Because if you play the game, you've got to work it out for yourself. And if you look at life nowadays, kids have gadgets to solve all their problems. You know, we've got, you know, I mean, I was looking after my twin nieces a couple of years ago, and they had homework to do, and I promised their mum I would do it with them, even though it was maths, which I'm rubbish at. And we got to one question that I said, oh, I'm not really too sure about that one. I said, we might just have to look that up. And she went, it's okay, I'll ask Siri. And I said, oh, is that one of your pals? And then I got this immediate eye roll, like, oh my God, Auntie Judy, you're so embarrassing. And she just talked at her phone and got the answer. And I went, it's almost like life's too easy. So, well, when you link it to our sport, where you're having to think all the time, you're having to work things out, we have to make sure that all happens in their lives. So the parents need to understand that. Don't do everything for them. But also we have to introduce it into our coaching. Don't tell them everything as the coach. Ask them questions. Make them solve things.
Yeah. I think everyone in tennis is rubbish at maths. The person who invented the scoring system. Let's go in 15s. 15, 30, 40. What happened to 45? Do you know, I've never bothered looking it up. Why does the scoring go 15, 30, 40?
I've no idea. Absolutely no idea at all.
The first point you get 15 for, the second point you get 15 for, the third point you get 10 for. There's obviously got to be a fantastic reason for it, but I have absolutely no idea what happens. So being such a mental sport, do you think that's something that there's players out there with as much ability as, say, someone like Andy, but Andy's mental strength is the thing which takes him over? He was criticised for it for a long time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Did he work on it?
Yeah, I think what he's always been incredibly good at is the strategy, the tactics of a match. He's been incredibly good at reading a sport.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of that has come from the way that they were coached when they were very young, because I didn't try and coach them how to hit the ball.
Right.
I played the game with them. You know, the game that they see on TV, Love 15, 30, whatever. And I made it difficult for them because I was a good player and I could put the ball anywhere I liked. So if, for example, I'm playing him and I play a drop shot, he runs into the net, he plays the ball back, and I immediately throw the lob up over his head so he has to run back after it. And he loves the chase, as you will know if you've watched him playing tennis. He loves the chase and the challenge. And he'd run back and he'd get it, by which time I've come up to the net. He's little thing, he dumps it up, and then I could just put the volley away. And because I never let them win when they were little. But my point was really, kids learn best by copying.
Yeah.
And he will think, I said, see how difficult I made that for you there. Yeah, I brought you into the net over your head, and then I was ready because I knew you'd hit it up, and then I'd just knock it over there. Because then they'll copy, because he'll go, oh, yeah, you're right. And then he starts trying to play a drop shot and knock it over my head.
What's the difference between, you said Jamie's a great doubles player and he's a great singles player. What's the different abilities you need, attributes you need to play those two then?
Well, you know what's interesting about the fact that they are brothers who are 15 months apart. They both play tennis for a living. They play different disciplines of the sport, which I'm internally grateful for. It's much better for family harmony. But Andy, if you watch Andy playing, when he was little, he loved Andre Agassi. He plays quite like Andre Agassi. He's a baseline counter puncher.
Right.
Jamie loved watching all the serve and volleyers.
Okay.
He loved getting up to the net as quickly as possible. Even from 9, 10, 11 years old, that's how he wanted to play. So I always think that if he had been born many years earlier in the grass court era, you know, when the game was slower and everybody served and volleyed, he probably would have been a much more successful singles player. But actually, the things he enjoyed about tennis are perfectly suited for doubles. So therefore, when you understand their game styles, their personalities and their physicalities, and who they admired growing up, it doesn't really surprise me the route that they went with their styles of play. Mm.
Could they have won their tournaments? Could they have been as good as they have become without you?
Well, they would. You always need somebody to create the opportunity. You need talent, you need the opportunity. And the opportunity comes in all sorts of forms. It can come in being near a facility, being near a good coach, could come in money. It can come in all sorts of things. But I think probably coming from Scotland, where there was no infrastructure, I think they would have been more likely to go down a golf and football route.
Yeah, I think after reading the book, I can answer the question. I don't think they'd have been able to do it without you. You've really done, you know, an amazing job for them. What is it like being? Let's talk a bit about you and your celebrity, because you do talk about in your book becoming famous off the back of your sons is quite something hard to deal with, because it wasn't something that you were ready for. It wasn't something you were expecting, was it?
No, I think, I mean, you know, when you start out, you have no idea where you're going, and you certainly have no idea where you're going to end up. And the number of things that I've had to learn along the way, sometimes out of necessity, well, nearly all out of necessity, sometimes that necessity of, I need to learn how to handle PR or learn more about the media. I went off and did a PR course because somebody needs to do that for them. They're not going to be able to do it themselves, and I needed to understand it. I learned how to do tax returns in three different countries because somebody's got to do that. I mean, how boring is that? But you've got to, you know, because you earn money in different countries because you're traveling and blah, blah, blah. So there's nobody else to do it, or you don't have the money to pay somebody else to do it. So I kind of learned all sorts of things, and, you know, it was always sort of there, but more, I would say, in the background. They always had coaches who had to be paid for, and teams of people who had to be paid for and make sure everybody's in the right place at the right time, that the flights are booked and all the rest of it. Now he has a management company that does all of those things for him, and they don't need to do it. But in the early days, you have to do it because they're young. They can't do it for themselves, and they can't employ a team of older guys because they don't know how to. Somebody's you know, really got to do all of that stuff. But I think that, you know, probably started when I became the Fed Cup captain. Started to create a bit more of a profile as a coach, because in those years from being the Scottish national coach to becoming Fed Cup captain, which was probably about 8 years, I'd largely become Andy and Jamie's mum.
Yeah.
And not a coach. And then suddenly I was the Fed Cup captain, which was a wonderful experience for me and great opportunity. And then Andy won Wimbledon. I started to do a little bit more. And that's when I got asked if I would like to do Strictly. You know, early 2014, I got asked to do that. And that was, for me, was just one of those things. It was the first thing that I had done for myself in years and years and years. And I really wanted to do it because I loved Strictly. And so, I thought, I'm going to have to tell the boys and see what they think about it, because obviously everything that each of us does impacts on the other.
Yeah.
And so I asked Jamie the easier option first, and he said, oh, Mom, you love that show. Go on, you'll have a great time. And I asked Andy, and he said, oh my God, you'll be rubbish. And the funny thing was, they were both right, because I did love it and I was rubbish. But I had no idea that Strictly was going to raise my profile so hugely, because, you know, you're doing it for the fun of it, but you suddenly realize after you've done the first show that you're in front of 10 to 14 million people every Saturday night, and suddenly people are recognizing you in the street. But it's made a lot more people interested in what I do tennis-wise. So I hopefully I've used it to my advantage.
Yeah, what did you make? So you loved the experience, didn't you?
I did. I absolutely loved it. You should do it.
Anton de Beck.
Oh, he's the best.
I used to go down with Simon when Simon Rimmer was on and watch it. And I didn't really have much of an interest in it until I used to go and watch him. And just the buzz around, it's like a sporting event,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And the adrenaline and the nerves from the contestants is phenomenal. And also the pros.
Yeah.
They love it as well. And it's quite an amazing thing. When you actually go down, it's like watching a sporting event, watching all the people come out and stuff like that. I'd probably consider doing it now, but you know, years ago, I'd have thought, no, it's not really my thing. But it's amazing, isn't it?
You need to be able to park your life for at least 3 months, maybe 4 months. You know, there's quite a lot to, you don't know how.
Did you think you'd be good at it?
I thought I would be better than I was because of being sporty.
And competitive.
That surprised me. The thing that surprised me about it, I just didn't want to be the first one off because I thought my kids will kill me if I'm the first one off. I'll be the biggest embarrassment ever. But actually, as the weeks went on, it's not that you're trying to win it. You just don't want to go off.
Yeah.
You just want to stay in it because you're having having such a great time. But I thought I'd be better at it. But I think what occurred to me was that when I did it, I was 55 and I'd never danced ever. I'm not nightclubby or disco-y, never have been. So I was learning a brand new skill at 55, and it's much harder to learn something new as you get older because your brain just doesn't retain things the way that it perhaps did when you're younger. You're learning a set routine with your feet, whereas when in sport, you're not. You're moving with instinct. You don't think about it. And I was having to think about every single step. And then it wasn't just the steps. It was the arms and the hands and the shoulder and the neck and the face and what angle you put your head at. And it was just all too much. And the other thing was that my partner was so much great fun. I don't think I was concentrating half the time because I was just having a great time.
Yeah, he's
so
great,
consequently, man. I was rubbish. But he was wonderful.
What did Andy and Jamie make of it then when you were actually on it?
Well, you know what? This was really interesting for me because once they got over the first few weeks of like, oh my God, look at my mum all dressed up with all that stuff. And Jamie actually became quite competitive with it. He would say, what are you doing this week, mum? And he would send me clips from YouTube of the dance that I was doing and say, right, watch this, you've got to do that. He started almost like trying to coach me.
Brilliant.
And pretty much every week he went into performance mode. You know, it's a competition, you need to get better. And he would say to me, mum, you're not getting any better. And at one time he said to me, is Anton pushing you hard enough? Should we think about bringing in another coach to help you? And I was like,
Brilliant.
Are you talking about? You know, like just having a great time. But that fascinated me that he went completely into competitor.
He'd learn off you.
Yeah. But what? And Andy was, I think for him, I just remember him. He was, because he was nearly always abroad, but he was always on top of the show. And he would be sending me messages after the judges had done all their comments saying, oh, more court 18 than center court. Or, you know, and I'm going, I said, how are you watching that? He's going, oh, I've got it on a feed in Vienna or wherever he was. So they were really into it. And I think what Andy loved about it was the number of people who said to him, we saw your mum on Strictly. She's doing great. She looks fantastic. Whatever. She's having a great time. And he loved that because I think one of his worries when I said I would do it would be about you're opening yourself up to a huge audience. Yeah. And because he'd seen me being criticised, I think, for so many years, he was worried about that.
It must be quite tough on Andy and Jamie having their mum criticised as the press decide to take you apart. You know, you're worrying about Andy and Jamie and they're worrying about you at the same time. It must be quite tough, Yeah, weird thing to go through. Actually, it's interesting to talk about coaches there with Jamie. Tennis players go through so many coaches, don't they? Is it just because it's relentless and it's tough to keep that relationship going with them?
Yeah, it is because, you know, if you're in a one-on-one relationship, you know, if you're, there's as much pressure on the coach as there is on the player. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's why it's so important it's difficult to get the right fit of someone who can offer the skill set and experience that you're looking for and the personality fit, because you're going to have to go for dinner with that person most nights of the week.
Yeah,
you're having to spend time on court, off court, traveling. You know, it's a very intense relationship. And so it doesn't surprise me how often you have, you know, splits.
Mm.
But you need different people at different times of your career. You know, Andy's had quite a few coaches, but you know, every coach has inputted in a positive way at every step of his career.
Do you help him make the decisions?
Not now, no, not for a while, actually. I think he's more than capable of doing that himself. And it is the being comfortable with somebody, being able to speak to them, being able to talk about your worries, your fears, your ideas of how you want to play, what you want to add to your game. I think when you're younger, you find a lot of coaches who tell you what to do all the time. And actually, he got to a stage, actually at quite a young age, probably in his early 20s, where he wanted to be in charge of how he wanted to play. You need somebody to help you, but it's like, this is what suits me the best.
What goes behind making a number one tennis player? You've obviously got your coach, and they have their management.
Yeah.
What else do they have? Dietitians and physios? Yeah. And I mean, how many different people does it take to get to as
well? You're always looking for, you know, if you get into the top 10 or even the top 5 and you're looking for, what's the difference between 5 and 4 and 3 and 2, 1? It's little tiny differences, and it's often people who bring particular areas of expertise that can create those small margins. Mm. So whether that's you need physio, you need a fitness trainer, you know, you need somebody to get your body doing what you need it to do. You know, if you're playing in a Grand Slam, you could be out there for 5 hours. You have a day's rest and you have to go again for another 5 hours. So the fitness trainer is really important. If you're putting your body through that amount of stress, you need a physio to look after your body.
Yeah.
So you need those two. Of course, you need a coach. Sometimes you might need a hitting partner as well if your coach is unable to hit. If you find a coach who can still spar, then that's great. Although you can obviously hit with other players. But if you hit with other players, you're more likely to do that if you want practice matches or practice sets.
Right.
If you want to work on something in your game, you'll do that with your coach and a hitting partner. So you might need a video analyst, you know, somebody who picks up the USB stick of your match, which you get from the ATP tour at the end of the match, and sticks it in the computer and analyzes it and feeds through with the coach. So you've got stuff to feed back to the player. You need somebody to do all your logistics, which is more your management team. Somebody doing the PR. You need a financial advisor. There's all sorts of people. So I went from learning how to coach to eventually, at one stage, learning to manage a team of people on the tennis side and a team of people on the business side, until Andy was old enough to be able to go and do all of that, you know, manage that sort of side of it yourself. But, you know, it's so important that you have the right people around you. So important. And you never know if you've got the right people or not. But
Well, we had a golden era for the last 10 years or something with Federer, Nadal, Djokovic and Andy. I mean, they were incredible, weren't they? I mean, did you ever think he was going to break through those three? Because they were phenomenal,
yeah,
weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the strength and depth in the men's game is huge. But that top four, I mean, the level was just, you know, just incredible. I mean, I can't remember the stats on Andy. Obviously, he's won 3 slams and 2 Olympics and a Davis Cup. But his semi-final record in slams over the last 10 years or so is just phenomenal. You know, and people often say to him, you know, if you'd been in another era, you know, you would have won a lot more slams. How do you feel about that? And he always says, well, you know, we've all pushed each other. And actually, he feels incredibly lucky to have played in that era with Fed and Novak and Rafa. And, you know, he and Novak they've known each other since they were 11, and Rafa's a year older than Andy, same age as Jamie. So we've known them all since they were about 11 years old. So they're like part of our furniture, if you know what I mean, because they've just always been there. And it's incredible to see them all at the top of the game. And also, I think with Novak, Rafa and Andy, they all spend a lot of time, you know, whether that's on the ATP Player Council, they spend time giving back to the game, you know, making decisions to make the game, help to make the game better. Jamie's on the Player Council as well. It's one of the things I'm really glad about, that they give back, they get involved in the future of their sport.
Okay, how good is British tennis now then? How are we going to be having more champions come along?
Just, and you need to wait and see. I mean, I think Kyle Edmonds had a good rise up into the top 20, which is encouraging. Joe Konta getting into the top 10 was also encouraging. She slipped back a bit, but I don't see any reason why she can't get back up to where she was. But for me, it's for us to be a strong tennis nation, it's all about numbers. And our numbers are, we don't have a culture of tennis in Britain. For me, we won't sort out our problems in performance side. until we solve our problems in grassroots. And for me, that's about taking tennis out to many more people, making it affordable and accessible. That's exactly what I'm doing, because I can see how I came away from the top end of the game completely, because I could see that I could have more long-term effect on tennis by going into the grassroots and kind of sharing my philosophy of how to coach and trying to get more people involved in not just coaching, but delivering tennis, you know, running fun competitions, because it's all about showcasing it. It's all about Pied Pipers and making it fun, because we're just competing with so many other things for kids and adults' attention that if we don't make it fun and stimulating, they'll find something else to do.
Your passion for tennis comes across in this book, in Bucket Low. You love the sport, don't you?
I do.
You absolutely love it. Do you enjoy being a celebrity now? You're good at it.
I could live without it. Having said that,
did you enjoy coming on Sunday Brunch?
Yeah, I did. Because I love to see how these programs are made. I love to see behind the scenes. I love meeting new people. You know, and when you go on something like that, you meet so many people you never would have the chance to otherwise meet. I made some great friends out of Strictly, unbelievable friends. You know, coming on Sunday Brunch and meeting Adam Lambert. And you know that the guys that were doing the music, and Joe Brand, that's just so much fun to sit there and banter
the band
with
was
everybody.
That day. Do you remember? I can't remember who it was.
They were Scottish, and they've got a funny name, and it's just escaped
me.
I
can't remember now. I'll look it up later. Hey, but you're a good guest though, and the reason why you're a good guest is you're honest and you don't mind talking about stuff. You know, there wasn't this list of demands of things you couldn't talk about, which is always good. You were comfortable and you just seem to enjoy yourself, and I think that's half the battle is get in there and enjoy yourself.
I think when you go into something that's not really your world, you have to go in with that attitude of you either embrace it or you run away from it. Yeah. And I realized, I think that the more that I was in the public eye through the tennis side of things, it's right now I use my voice a lot to promote women's sport. I do that a lot. I go out on a limb a lot to do that and lend my voice to things. But yeah, it's just like, right, okay, this is just how it's going to be. And so I'm going to go out and enjoy it. And I would say for the most part, I enjoy all the opportunities that it's afforded me. I think there are pros and cons with everything. And sometimes I just quite like to get home and shut the door and not speak to anybody for days on end. But
well, thank you for doing this podcast. Your book is very good read. It's very enjoyable. If you want to know what went into making Andy and Jamie, then it's all in there. I've got some questions to ask all my guests who come on. So I'm going to ask you, what one piece of advice has been invaluable to your life?
I think it's not about what you have. It's what you do with what you have.
Okay, expand on that.
Well, I think it kind of goes back to, you know, that whole thing of don't wait for people to do things for you. If you see something that either needs to be done or you want to do, go and do it yourself. I think we live in a bit of an entitlement world, certainly in relation to tennis, and that whole thing of it's not about what you have, it's what you do with what you have, is it probably relates to the backdrop of tennis in Scotland, of when I started as the national coach. Well, why shouldn't we produce world-class tennis players? Because we've only got 4 indoor courts in the whole country and no money and no coaches. Why shouldn't we? We'll just learn how to do it.
That's it. I don't know whether you like talking about this or not, and I hope I'm not springing this on you, but how did Dunblane, the tragedy in Dunblane, how did that affect you in your life? Because it was quite a terribly horrific thing which happened, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 1996. It's a long time ago.
Do you like talking about it or not really?
I don't mind talking about it, because I've been asked about it quite a number of times. It probably helps you to talk about it a bit. I don't like over talking about it. But you never would have imagined something like that happening in your little town. And but what it made me realize, I had a number of friends who lost their children that day, and you go through that guilt of feeling so incredibly relieved that your kids are safe, and then feeling bad about being relieved because your friends have lost kids. But I think
Just to remind, if anyone doesn't know, there was a shooting at the primary school in Dunblane, and both Jamie and Andy were in the school. And in your book, you do this bit where you write about it, and you say the traffic was so bad with the parents getting out.
Yeah.
You just stopped the car, the car was stopped. You got out and just ran a quarter of a mile to the school. And being a dad myself, my heart was going, thinking, Christ, that moment when you're running to the school, not knowing what happens, and then you discuss that is absolute relief, but then sort of guilt because other people had lost their children that day.
Yeah, I think we heard something on the radio that said there'd been a shooting at the school, and then my mum ran a toy shop in the town centre at the time, and I was working in there that morning, and she came running and said, you know, what had that there had been a shooting at the school. And I grabbed my car keys and jumped in the car, ran, abandoned the car because everybody was trying to do the same thing, get to the school. And this was in the days before mobile phones, so nobody knew what was going on. And, you know, we were all at the school gates for hours and hours and hours. And eventually we found out which class had been had been in the gym at the time. And, you know, I got Jamie and Andy out of the school many, many hours later, and they had no idea what had gone on. They knew that a man had been in the school with a gun, and that was all they knew. They'd been fed in the classrooms. The teachers and all the other support staff had managed to keep everything from them and keep them safe and keep them fed and keep them calm. You know, when there was police cars and ambulances and things going on outside, it was really quite incredible job that the teachers and everybody did at the school that day. And but really, I mean, going forward from there, you realise after a period of time that life has to go on, and everything that I did at the tennis club became even more important to me on behalf of the children and the town. You know, this was a place where the kids go, they play. So we picked everything up and we kept going. We did even more than we did before. But for me, it was definitely about, it really showed me that you never know what's around the corner, and that you should absolutely grasp life and go after it. And if there's something that you want to do, you should go and do it, because you know, I could have lost my kids that day. Many parents did, but and maybe that is that whole thing, you know, you appreciate them so much and you want to create the opportunities, you want them to enjoy what they're doing. And yeah,
as a person, you've experienced extremes of emotions, haven't you, in your life, with that sort of tragedy happening, and then the criticism of yourself, the criticism of your son, them going on to win tournaments, the highs and lows.
Yeah.
You must have been through quite a lot of extreme emotions.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm still thin.
All right, what's the biggest mistake, or have you made any what's the biggest mistake you made, or have you made any mistakes that you want to talk about?
Oh, I've probably made loads of mistakes. I think the biggest mistake was you know, letting Jamie go down south to train when he was young. I see that as a huge mistake from me. And, you know, being flattered by somebody saying that he was exceptional and all the rest of it, and offering something that was basically free of charge, and, you know, posh boarding school, tennis program all created for and everything, and thinking that was such a great option for him. He desperately wanted to go, and not trusting my instinct of thinking, oh, you know, he's really young and so forth. But anyway, you learn from your mistakes, and obviously didn't make the same mistake with Andy.
What advice would you give to a parent who has got a son or a daughter who's excellent at sport, they're in a program somewhere, or they're trying to get in a program, or they're showing potential? What advice would you give to them?
Well, I think, you know, everyone's an individual. Everybody's circumstances is different. It's why I find it tough when parents or coaches come up to me and ask for advice on a particular player. Because if I don't know that player as a person or as a player, you can't. You can just give general bits of information. I mean, so much is about finding an environment in which they can thrive. And environments generally are created by people. You know, and it's finding people who know what they're doing, who have a track record, who understand kids, who understand it's more important to develop the skills and the game, whatever game it is they're playing or whatever hobby they're doing. And it's not about the winning and the losing. I think that's probably my my biggest thing is that you need to kind of be in it for the long haul and don't set goals that are too far away from them. Just go small steps at a time and you will get there, because that's exactly what I did. What's the next stage? What do I need to be able to do now? What do I need to be able to provide? Whereas if I'd set out with a goal of saying, right, I'm going to create players in the world top 50, it'd been far too far away for a 12-year-old.
And do you have to make sure that the child is driving it as well, that there is...
That's really important, that the kids are doing it because they love it, not because the parents are kind of forcing them or pushing them towards doing it. There's a big difference between parents who push the children to do things than parents who push to try and make things happen for their kids, because sometimes you do have to push to open doors, no question, and it's the parents that's got to do it for the kids. It's up to the kids to take advantage of the opportunity. But the child doing it for the fun of it and the love of it is the most important thing. And when I look at my kids now doing what they do, they still love it. They're still having fun. And that was all stimulated from the environments that they came through during their formative years, no question.
Any life hacks?
What's that?
I don't know, travel tips or how to give
up. Oh, yeah, I've got a good travel tip for you. Always travel with clothes pegs. And you're going to say why?
Why?
Because I don't so much now, but used to travel a lot across different time zones, and so it can really affect your sleep pattern. And you could always sleep better if the curtains are fully closed. And often, if light gets in, it wakes you up before you want to waken up. So always travel with clothes pegs, and I pin curtains together so that no light can get in. So I always set the alarm, of course, but it helps me to get back into a time zone. So that's a big thing for me. And I think when the boys were younger and we were traveling and we had no money, we were staying in the cheapest of the cheap accommodation. And these little washing lines that you can get that are on little rubber suckers that you can hang across the bath. So do all the washing in the bath, and then I would hang it up on these rubber suckers, or like an elasticated washing line. Invaluable if you're traveling with young tennis players.
I imagine Andy's life is a million miles away from that now. Any books you recommend apart from your own?
Actually, I read a really great book not so long ago. I love Val McDermid. She's a Scottish crime writer.
Right.
She was behind the Wire in the Blood TV series. Okay. That was all her books. I love her books. But one of the best books I read was called 1,000 White Women. And it's a diary of this woman who was one of 1,000 white women who were traded with the US government and the Cheyenne Indians way, 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 way back. And it's her diary of her who had been locked up in a lunatic asylum by her family. There was nothing wrong with her. She had had children out of wedlock or something like that, so they ended up having her institutionalized. And she ended up on this Cheyenne tribe and learning how to speak the language, become a wife of an Indian and all the rest of it. It's absolutely fascinating. Couldn't put it down.
Okay.
You weren't expecting that,
no,
were you?
No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't at all. The new question we ask is, Johnny Vegas wanted to be a mod when he was younger. Do you ever identify as anything? Did you ever want to be anything like a mod or something? Or were you into any bands or music that you became something?
You know, I was a Bay City Rollers fan.
Really?
Yeah.
What did they sing? Baby, I Love You.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Shang-a-lang.
Did you have tartan things around your wrist?
Of course I did. Like tartan dish towels. That's kind of what they were like. Scarves they were. And the flared short trousers with the tartan trim around them, and the shirts with the tartan pockets and all the rest of it. Yeah, I was a huge Bay City Rollers fan. And a few years ago, they got a reunion tour in Edinburgh, and I put something on my Twitter about it that I was going, and I got invited to go backstage to the green room to meet them all.
They're not as young as they used to be, are they?
Oh no. It didn't make any difference. I was like, you know, I was like, I don't get really phased meeting people. I was absolutely gone meeting them. They were amazing.
Really?
And then, you know, I was in an audience that was predominantly 50-something women, you know, like menopausal women. And we all knew all the words to everything, and we're up and we're dancing. And it was one of the best nights of my life. So Bay City Rollers.
They've got another sort of Shang-a-lang or something. What was it? I don't know.
We sang Shang-a-lang and we ran with the gang.
There you go. I do know a bit of Bay City Rollers. Final question for you. What is the meaning of life, Judy Murray?
I think it's about... I think it's about following your dreams, and I think it's about taking advantage of it. Just, you know, I don't want to get to the end of my life and look back and go, I wish I'd done this and I wish I'd done that. And I think that in the last 5 or 6 years, if I've wanted to do something, I mean, I got a tattoo.
Have you?
Yeah, what? A spider.
Wow. A spider. Why a spider?
Robert the Bruce. Robert the Bruce, that old
the
Scottish story of Robert the Bruce imprisoned in a cave and all hope is lost, and he watches a spider trying to spin a web across the cave and failing and failing and failing and getting up and trying again, and eventually she succeeds because she's a she spider. And it's a bit like when I finished the book, because everything was, you know, spent so much of time people putting me down and saying, go away, don't be silly, you'll never do it. I mean, if I'd listened to people, I would have given up long, long, long ago, and none of it would have happened. So I thought, you know what? I'm like Robert the Bruce and that spider. I'm going to get a spider when I finish my book. So I did it. And I never would have done that when I was a student, for example, even though I'd wanted to. And now, for me, it is, you realize you're coming to the last section of your life. And it's like, if I want to do something now, I'm just going to go off and do it.
Go on then, we all want to know, what did Andy and Jamie think of you getting a spider tattooed on yourself?
There was a significant amount of eye rolling.
I wonder what they think. Oh no, they must phone each other up. Have you heard? Mum's got a spider tattooed on herself. What is happening? You must pinch yourself sometimes, mustn't you? Your life's been quite amazing, really, because from the, you know, when you start the book and back in the day, and now you end up on Strictly, you've got sons who are number one tennis players. It's, you know, you've been integral in the British and the Scottish tennis scene. I mean, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, what you've and done. Then I get to sit in your kitchen. Hey! I mean, that's great.
There you go. There you go.
And the Bay City
Rollers. Yeah, and got to meet the Bay City Rollers. Judy, thank you so much for doing the podcast. If people want to follow you, where do they do it? It's just on Twitter at Judy Murray.
Yeah, I've got a Twitter account. I tweet about all sorts of things, Tennessee things, cakes a lot, Hibs Football Club. Funny things. I do a lot of motherisms. My mum is she doesn't know she's being funny, but she is actually very funny. But yeah, I do Twitter and you can read my book.
And if anyone wants to get involved in any of your coaching things or your misfits, is that just a website on?
Yeah, we've got sherallies.com. Get hyphen involved. If there are any women listening who want to get involved in tennis, running things, organizing things, starter coaching, we've got people in your area and there are things going on all the time. Mm. So yeah, we'd love to have you.
And are you looking for people to take up tennis at any age?
Yeah, I think so. I think so much, probably too much emphasis has been put on to getting kids in at a very young age. Mm. For me, we need to spend just as much time getting adults and older teenagers in, because it's the adults who will make things happen within the clubs and the parks and the schools and all the rest of it. So big believer in growing the older side of the game.
There is an amazing feeling when you hit a ball, top spin, forehand, and it goes in just inside the line.
I'll tell my dad.
With a bit, yeah. And now when I hit it, I can think, yes, Judy's dad invented that shot. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Cheers, Judy.
I was Judy Murray. Thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with her.
I have to admit something.
What?
I was kind of taken in by the media representation of her.
So was I.
I wasn't sure. I don't mean recently been sure, but when she was first in the public eye, I wasn't sure about her.
100%, I agree.
It's bad, isn't it?
Terrible, because she knows that. That's what people think of her. And she writes about it in her book.
She's so nice.
She is. And the amount of dedication she put into her boys is absolutely phenomenal. And then she, the boys
all being attacked, the whole family being nailed by the media. Yeah. It's horrible, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It is really bad. It's really bad what we do to people, what the media does to people. Anyway,
I was sitting there thinking, flipping heck, life is too short.
Yeah,
just to keep hounding people in the press.
What did amuse me though, I said thank you so, as she left, I said thank you so much for doing that, Judy. Really, th- thoroughly enjoyed that. And she said, oh no, thanks, I enjoyed that. I said, say hello to Andy for me. He says, I will, I'll phone him up and he'll say, oh mum, you didn't try and be funny, did you? Which I like. Yeah, no, so that was really enjoyable. I learned a lot as well, which is nice. Did you learn stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I was actually really enjoying, I don't know enough about tennis. I mean, I watch it. I don't know enough about the technicality.
Well, you watch it for 2 weeks a year.
But she was actually, yeah, exactly. But she's actually really interesting about it. I'm interested about what goes into the team behind
it. What did you think of Andy then?
Again, I think I was taken a little bit by the media representation of the whole thing.
That annoyed me so much because I met Andy when he was young and I just thought...
It's different if you've met him.
It's funny, yeah. And I used to say to people all the time, meet the guy, he's really funny.
Well, we don't all
it's
have really... an opportunity to do that, Tim, because we're not jet-setting international TV personalities like you.
But they always hammer people and then you get to meet them and you think, do you know what, they're really just nice people. But Andy was just a winner. Yeah. You could tell from the first moment I met him, I was like, God, this guy really is something else.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Tim Henman about him as well, and Tim Henman was like, this guy's brilliant, he's a winner, you know. And it's like, you know, so it's such a shame when that you have to go and defend yourself all the time. But I think people have come around to Andy now, haven't they, after the Olympics?
I think that was a big turn.
Everybody
likes him because he was on Mock the Week.
was he on Mock the Week?
He was on really briefly. They were doing a load of Andy Murray jokes, weren't they, and him and his wife were sat up, or was it girlfriend at the time, and maybe his wife. And he was sat in the audience and they kept panning to him and he was laughing his head off.
Oh, cool. All right, listen, if you want to join in, you can, but we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com or you can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy. Love to know what you think of the podcast. Love to know what you think of Judy Murray and anything else you want to. And we're still looking, we're going to do another mailbag very soon.
Yeah.
So if you've got any problems or any suggestions, we've had a couple of cracking emails in recently over the last couple of days, so keep those coming in and we'll try and get them read out. And I think that's it from this one. So I'll see you very soon. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.